harrowing kills, though most were obvious myths. Irene gave the men direction. They were to let Rodion and his troop pass through the yard unmolested. Once the interlopers were past, the porters would follow Irene into the tunnel, where they would flank Rodion and confront him in the port. They were not to reveal themselves until ordered to do so. Sandlin had decided to delay the announcement of the cancelled pay raise. Tomorrow he would be gone, leaving Finn Gol holding the bag. If Gol wanted to trim wages in the middle of a turf war, that was his prerogative, and he could tell the men himself. Though war was not quite the right word for the coming scuffle. It would be a standoff, Senlin was sure. He expected saber-rattling, some bark and spittle, perhaps a little fencing, but neither Rodion nor Gol would want the threat to escalate. There was nothing to gain from killing one's co-workers, or from damaging the port through which all wealth flowed. No. Rodion would be put in his place, and Gol would get his due. The platform, from crane to bollard, was a symphony of groaning. Timbers and ropes shifted under the pressures of the approaching storm. Even the great iron struts added their bass complaints to the song. The graceful profile of the merchant ship, the Gold Finch, was lit up like a chandelier. Her crew worked hastily to batten down the hatches and redouble the tethers of the lozenge-shaped balloon. The ship's lookout, hardly more than a boy, clung to the bowsprit like a figurehead, watching the snow clouds billow nearer. Senlin marvelled at the composure the tower required of even the youngest souls. Babel aged its population with equal cruelty. If the Finch evoked a chandelier, the stone cloud, docked catty corner from it, resembled a lard candle. The scotched and buckshot hull, with its bulbous fore and tapered aft, knocked against the bumpers of the port ungracefully. Its ashen balloon bulged through the matrix of rigging like fat through fishnet. Not a single kind phrase came to mind when Senlin gazed upon the stone cloud, and yet, despite its homely face, he loved it to its bones. It was his ship. He only had to take it. Edith met him at the gangplank that soared back and forth over the drop. Her expression was grim. Behind her, a ramshackle crew of a dozen men hustled to clear the deck, inspected knots, and shoveled pans of coal into the furnace. The gusting wind made a discreet exchange impossible between them, but in response to Senlin's tentative smile, Edith gave a short, almost desperate shake of her head. Then she was abruptly forced to one side by Billy Lee. The captain gave Senlin his arm and half-jerked him over the gulf onto his ship. Senlin hit the deck awkwardly and had to stagger until he found a surer stance. The ship pitched beneath him.
"I'm here to sign your manifest," Senlin said, with admirable composure.
"You're a curious sot. You never said you were portmaster when I caught you fondly my first mate," Captain Billy Lee bellowed.
His emerald smock flapped against his puffed chest, and his hand rested on the cupped guard of the cutlass at his hip.
"But then, you're much more than you look." "I was hardly fondling her," Senlin said indignantly, and turned to Edith for support.
She had an entirely unfamiliar face on now. Her teeth showed, and her dark eyes caught no light. Disturbed, and a little confused, he turned again to find the tip of Lee's sword levelled at his nose. Instinctively, Senlin raised his hands.
"A girl at the pipe told me all about you this morning," Billy Lee said, and animated his speech with a cursive flourish of his sword. "This sweet little tart said that you were a marked man. I could hardly believe my luck."
"A fair-haired woman?" Senlin asked, knowing the answer already.
"I got the impression she was yapping to anything with a spare shekel and an ear-shaped hole. Everyone else took it for pillow talk, but me, I knew there was something to it."
Billy Lee called over his shoulder,
"Bring it out!"
A mutt-faced man in a skullcap carried over a small crate. Senlin immediately recognized it.
"You're wanted by the Commissioner. I wonder if this little box doesn't have something to do with it."
Senlin dropped his hands in disgust, which inspired the encircled crew to draw their swords. He'd never seen so much gleaming steel, and certainly had never been the focus of it. He felt like a pincushion. Even Edith had levelled her single-shot pistol at his head. She stood, scowling behind the bead. She had warned him of Billy Lee's treachery, and yet Senlin was more surprised by her aggressive show of loyalty than Lee's wolfish revelation. At least, he hoped it was only a show. He supposed Edith had little choice but to appear his enemy until the last possible moment.
"I am the master of the port of Gol," Senlin said, biting the words. "My employer is powerful, influential, and jealous of my time. You are accusing me based on the testimony of a prostitute and the evidence that I have engaged your services to deliver my mail. Is that the size of it?"
"Of course you would deny it,"
Captain Lee said, glancing briefly to one side. His sparse brown beard now seemed to have been pasted on, his uncertainty making him appear young and boastful. The flinch was enough to spur Senlin on.
"And on this damning proof, you are willing to poison your welcome at this port forever."
Senlin moved his daggering gaze over the rest of the motley and haggard crew.
"Do you really think that your lot, this ship, would be allowed to dock at Ginside Port or Erstmere? Where will you take on fuel in the future? I'm sure a spit-shine dandy like you is probably clutched to the bosom of every portmaster from the baths to the bell tower."
Immediately, Senlin sensed he had gone too far. He had pricked the young captain's pride.
"All right, then we'll settle it here."
Billy Lee put his curled-up boot toe on Senlin's crate.
"Open the box. Show us what's in there. If it has nothing to do with the business of the Commissioner, I'll say my sorries and you can go."
It was Senlin's turn to flinch, though he tried to hide it with outrage.
"Are you mad? I'm not going to open my private affairs for you to nose through. If this is how you operate, then I will collect my parcel and go."
"Oh, no, you won't,"
Billy said, straightening his cutlass again to Senlin's throat.
"If it hurts your feelings so much, Bobbitt will open it for you."
The dog-faced crewman in the skullcap drew a fat-bladed dagger from his hip. He knelt and began working the point under the lid of the crate. Senlin held his breath. The creak of the gangplank startled everyone aboard. Before anyone could recover from their surprise, a dozen of Rodion's men swarmed onto the ship. They were dressed in the plain breeches and wool coats of stagehands and ushers, though all had flamboyant touches to their clothes, wigs, feathers, scarves, and strings of beads. Where primitive tribes might favour war paint, these men preferred costume jewellery. The effect was bizarre. Regardless of their appearance, their purpose was plain enough. They came with sabres and pistols drawn. The invaders fairly swamped the port side of the ship. Another dozen of Rodion's men waited on the dock with long guns level and ready. Senlin was relieved by the interruption. He could only hope now that the rest of his plan would unfold peacefully. The ship would be unloaded and the cargo searched, and while everyone was engaged in that tedious business, he and his conspirators, his crew, would make off with the vacated ship. He glanced about for signs of Adam or Valita, but saw none. The ship, now overcrowded, began to sink under the new weight. The hull knocked jarringly against the cradle of the slip. Even amid the standoff, everyone had the sense to allow one of Lee's crew to fire the furnace. The ship lurched back to port level. With the ship secured, Rodion boarded, pompous as a duke. He wore a full-length cape, trimmed abundantly in matching black fur. The ivory stocks of twin pistols stood prominently at his belt. Rodion squared his shoulders toward Billy Lee, who seemed amused when he said,
"I saw you on stage. You're the horganist." "A comedian. If only I'd prepared a joke,"
Rodion said, glancing around disdainfully at the weathered fixtures, the chocks, cleats, and hatchrings.
"But I haven't come for you."
The ostentatious pimp turned to Senlin.
"I've been having the most fascinating conversation, Thomas. Bring them out."
He signalled one of his men stationed by the gangplank. Two figures were escorted aboard into the swinging, drunk light of the hurricane lamps. Senlin made a concerted effort to appear dismayed at Adam's appearance. Adam, playing his part, was unable to meet Senlin's gaze. At his side, Velita's wild black hair and large features were fairly buried under a shawl that appeared as heavy as a rug. She stared up at Senlin with unblinking, violet eyes.
"Adam! What have you done?" Senlin blurted.
Captain Lee interrupted the awkward reunion with gruff indignation.
"This is my ship, not a theatre. Take your penny opera elsewhere. I've changed my mind. I want nothing to do with any of this."
And yet he scooted Senlin's crate nearer to himself with the heel of his boot. Ignoring Billy Lee, Rodion continued with obvious pleasure.
"I have had my ears filled with such inspiring rumours about you. I hear you are a fugitive. I hear there may be some reward. I hear you are smuggling treasure."
Rodion put his hand on Adam's shoulder confidently.
"At least, I hope you are, for Adamos's sake. I've promised him that if he delivers me a fortune and proof that you have abused your station and swindled our kind employer, I will release his sister from her contract, though promises aren't as expensive as little girls,"
Rodion said, and pinched Velita's cheek. She smiled and giggled gamely, and then, with one dart of her neck, bit his finger. Rodion recoiled, raised his gloved hand to strike her, but stopped short.
"I would miss you so much, Velita. I need a new bed-warmer."
Though he'd been standing in glum defeat a moment before, Adam's head now snapped around at this.
"You will keep your promise, Rodion?"
"Of course, of course."
He inspected the teeth marks Velita had left on his leather glove.
"But we must finish the play. Too many dramatic questions remain. What is this treasure, and where is it now?"
"You should know," Senlin said, before he thought the utterance through.
"Why on earth should I know?"
"Because you're conspiring with Commissioner Pound," Senlin replied, seeing no reason for Rodion to conceal this obvious fact now.
"No one conspires with the Commissioner. He doesn't collaborate. He crushes and he takes. No, I'd sooner tell the devil my address than bring myself to the Commissioner's attention."
Rodion scoffed, and his surrounding men took to the signal and laughed in a chorus.
"When I turn you over to Pound, it'll be from a great distance and without negotiation. Let him send along whatever compensation seems fair to him. He'll get no argument from me."
Senlin was unsettled. If it hadn't been Rodion who called the Red Hand down on him, then who? Finn Gol must have exaggerated his dread of the tyrant. His patience at an abrupt end, Captain Billy Lee barked at his crew.
"Get these yappers off my ship!"
"Indeed,"
Rodion said, and pivoted about nonchalantly. He drew his pistol in the same casual gesture and shot Billy Lee just above the pyramid on his tabard. All watched as the cocksure young captain staggered back 3 steps and struck the bulwark. He flipped backward into the open air, leaving one boot standing empty on the deck. Edith had scarcely opened her mouth and drawn a breath before Rodion wheeled at her and fired his second pistol. The bullet ricocheted off her brush shoulder and struck one of Rodion's men in the forehead, knocking the feather from his ear and his brains from the back of his head. Edith recovered her voice before the man hit the floor.
"For Billy!"
Her cry cracked with rage. She drew the pistol from a comrade's belt and leveled it at Rodion. He threw one of his own men in front of her barrel, and the surprised man caught the full blow. The powder flash set his fur stole on fire. Edith drew her sword and charged Rodion. The whoremonger snatched the cutlass from the hand of the burning man and lifted the blade in time to receive Edith's first attack. Senlin found himself in the middle of a melee. The two sides did not come together neatly like dance partners or the teeth of two gears, as his sparring lessons had suggested they would. Instead, many fled and crashed together. Others fought in pairs and gangs, overwhelming and changing targets as randomly as a swarm of bees. Some of Lee's crew began to fire at the bank of Rodion's riflemen, who stood on the port, and they replied in dreadful kind. The volley of shots shattered the bulwark, severing lines and limbs as they passed over the deck. Wood and gore sprayed the air and caked the floor. A man cried out like a kicked dog. A shot pinged off the furnace and shattered a cabin window. A water barrel burst on deck, and its surf ran everywhere underfoot. It was madness. Belita buffeted against her brother's back as he retreated from a berserk crewman, the one called Bobbit, who was swinging a fire iron in wild, wide strokes. Adam, though strong from years of hard labour, was having trouble deflecting the heavy fire iron. The rod struck the back of a dueling stagehand, sending him sprawling headfirst into the grate of the ship's furnace. The stagehand screamed as his hair caught fire, and he leapt up to run, guttering over the starboard side. His torched head vanished like a shaken-out match. Seeing Valita's distress, Senlin pulled her from the thick of the battle and up the four stairs to the empty forecastle. Though a deal quieter than the main deck, the forecastle was a dead end, backed only by open air and curdling clouds full of snow. Senlin regretted the tactical decision almost at once, but he could see no safe path to the port. A new burst of gunfire sent them both diving to the floor. Rodion's fur-trimmed cape swelled and fell like a great bellows as he fought with Edith. They were evenly matched. Each attack was repaid with an equal riposte. Their battling spanned the deck, though their stage was littered with fallen men and the grim confetti of bullets. Rodion's saber rang against Edith's steel rapidly, like a butcher sharpening his knife. Even amid his frenzy, Rodion did not forget the precious investment he'd carried to battle. He called to his men.
"Catch the girl! 3 pieces to the man who catches her alive, and death to the man that slays her!"
One of Rodion's stagehands, a keg-chested man in a corn silk wig, dislodged his saber from a dead man's back and locked his eyes on Senlin, who stood hunkered atop the forecastle. Though he felt like a flimsy partition, Senlin held Valita behind him and his arrow-rod before him. He sorted through every piece of advice Iren had given him during their sparring lessons. He felt overly conscious of his feet. Were they too far apart? Was he standing pigeon-toed? The way he gripped the arrow-rod felt all wrong. Would he forget his lessons and swing it like an axe, leaving his centre open to any half-hearted lunge? It was too much to hold in his head. It was like the old panic he'd suffered before an exam. All his thorough studying turned to stuffing in his head, and a nervous paralysis descended upon him. He had lost already. But then, close behind him and almost into his ear, Valita said, "Don't try to reason with him. Just tap him on the head." This simple advice called to mind Irene's essential lesson. Don't think about it too much. The bull in the wig was looking determinedly at Senlin's legs from the bottom of the stairs, his sword already recoiling to strike at his knees. As soon as the brute touched the bottom step and was in reach, Senlin crowned him, knocking the man's wig askew. The brute reeled back and spit a mass of blood, that included half a tooth, onto the deck. He pulled the white blonde wig from his bald head and used it to wipe his mouth. When he reseated the wig, it was dishevelled and shocked with gore. He looked up, no longer focused on Senlin's knees. The bull-chested man charged the stairs, his sword aimed at Senlin's nose. Senlin managed to turn the blade aside, but he could not deflect the man. The brute bowled into him, and he was thrown against Valita. She half leapt and was half hurled over the cannon on the bowsprit. She caught the barrel with hooped arms, leaving her feet dangling over the abyss. Senlin could not help her. He was trapped beneath his attacker. The wigged man was slobbering blood on him and struggling to bring his sword to a useful angle. Before he could shift his blade, Senlin chopped at the man's throat with the heel of his hand and pulled his legs under him. He kicked the gasping brute back down the stairs, where he collided with another man and fell to the ground in a tangle. When Senlin got to his knees, and then his feet, he turned to find Valita standing perfectly balanced on the cannon barrel, holding the taut rigging that bound the ship to her balloon. Her shawl was gone, lost over the edge, which left her wearing only the blue leotard she performed in. He knew she must have been freezing, but she smiled even still and said,
"Aren't you the scrapper? They must have teased you in the schoolyard."
"You have no idea," Senlin said, dryly. He quickly moved the jailer's key from his coat to his pants pocket, and then pulled his arms from the coat. He helped her put it on. The coat hung on her shoulders, loose as a shroud.
"Why are you carrying bricks around in your pockets?" she asked.
"They're books. Drop them if you have to. You should climb into the rigging and stay there until the ship is clear. Soon as it's safe to come down, start undoing the portside lines. Leave the crib anchors for last." He gripped her shoulder and said, "Don't lose the coat, whatever you do. It is very important that you keep it safe."
"Don't worry. Whatever happens to me, your coat will survive. Long live fashion," she said.
And Senlin could only roll his eyes. She climbed the rigging toward the belly of the balloon, quickly, quietly, like a billowing black flag. On the main deck, Adam had waited Bobbit out. The skull-capped crewman, increasingly exhausted from hauling the fire iron back and forth, now swung with more enthusiasm than he had strength to control. When the iron clipped a balustrade and snagged there, Adam drove his sword between the man's ribs. Bobbit collapsed into a writhing ball and hissed in agony. Adam searched for Senlin and found the portmaster coming down from the forecastle. Anxiously, Adam asked after his sister, and Senlin said where he'd sent her. They were interrupted by a stagehand in a bowler attempting to broadside them, but Adam deftly parried the man's thrust, and Senlin used his aero rod to bat the man into the riser of the forecastle.
"It's turned into a slaughterhouse," Senlin said. "If Gol doesn't arrive soon, we'll be lost."
He'd been taken by surprise when Rodion dispatched Captain Lee, and could only hope now that Gol would restore some measure of sanity to the scene. The wind and the agitation of bodies made the moored vessel swing and twist on its anchors. The water that had spilled on the deck was rapidly turning to ice. Between crossed swords and the flail of limbs, Senlin spied Edith, still sparring with Rodion. She executed a well-timed advance, a sudden leap forward followed by a rapid lunge, and Rodion was driven back against the starboard rail. His sword wagged weakly as he fumbled to steady himself. Edith pursued the advantage and grabbed the whoremonger's blade with her mechanical hand. With an effortless flick of the wrist, she snapped the blade near the hilt. But just as it seemed she had disarmed the villain, Rodion twisted about, and using the stump of his blade, severed the line to one of the starboard anchors. The ship bucked wildly as the remaining moorings and the balloon fought for a new equilibrium. Raiders and crew alike were sent skidding down the tilted deck toward the gap between ship and port. Half a dozen corpses and three live men were thrown overboard in an instant, their passage made more hopeless and swift by the ice on the deck. Thrown to his back, Senlin was fortunate enough to slide against the stairs of the quarterdeck. Adam also had caught a foothold on the lip of a hatch. But Edith was not so lucky. Senlin watched in mute horror as she skated on her side, arms grasping after some handle. Helplessly, fluidly, she passed through a gap in the railing and vanished into the breach with a choked scream. The image of Edith tumbling through the emptiness overran every other thought. Senlin smashed his hands to his ears to cover the echo of her strangled cry. But the scream did not diminish. Suddenly, his plan seemed worse than foolhardy. It was murderous. He alone was responsible for this bloodshed. He was the arrogant engineer of all this confusion and death. It was not fair that she, who already suffered so much, be punished a second time for keeping his company. It was not fair, but neither was it a surprise. Not if he was honest. Obsession made him dangerous to his friends. They fell so he could climb. He knew action was required. He must do something. But there wasn't a ploy left in his head. Rodion, who had held on to the high rail when the ship pitched, knew exactly how to respond. He gave quick orders for his men to disarm the crew of the Stone Cloud. Leaderless and few, they put up little resistance. Senlin felt the aero rod yanked from his hand. He was hauled roughly to his feet. A new gangplank was set to the listing ship, and he and Adam were escorted across. He rolled his head back to keep from looking down at the terrible chasm Edith had just fallen into, and by chance caught a glimpse of Valita hiding at the limit of the lamplight, high in the rigging. At least she had escaped detection. Perhaps Rodion would presume she had fallen overboard amid the chaos. Perhaps someone would survive this folly. The sight of Valita stirred him from his shock. He could not give up just because he had failed Edith. There were other lives at stake, and there was hope yet. Rodion salvaged Senlin's crate from a pile of debris at the port railing and carried it onto the pier with an air of triumph. Senlin and Adam were forced to their knees before Rodion. Senlin watched as his aero rod was handed to the whoremonger. He bandied it about experimentally.
"I think it's funny that a bookworm like you should carry about such a crude club. At least that monstrous woman could swing a sword. She was fun."
He tossed the rod over his shoulder, and it went clanking across the timbers of the port. Rodion began the process of reloading his pistols, feeding a pinch of black powder into the pan of one.
"Where's the girl? Where's Valita?" Rodion asked a stagehand, with a bent nose and a feather boa looped about his neck.
The man gave a doubtful shrug and shook his head.
"Thank you, Harold."
Rodion looked down at Adam, who craned up, a bloom of rage reddening his eyes.
"I hereby release your sister from her contract. Consider it a bereavement gift."
A gunshot startled Senlin. He cast his head toward the sound in time to see one of Rodion's men shoot a second of the Stone Cloud's crew in the back. The shot man tumbled forward over the edge of the port, and the executioner moved on to the next in a row of four remaining men. In the skirts, the dead were raining. Senlin quickly looked away. Rodion was speaking again, though he was regularly interrupted by another shot.
"Now, where were we?"
He packed a square of wadding and a ball into the barrel of his pistol.
"Ah, yes. What's in the box, Thomas?"
"Why don't you open it and find out?"
"I must have misphrased the question."
Rodion pulled back the hammer and lowered the pistol to Senlin's head.
"What's in the box?" "What have we here?"
a voice called from behind. Gol emerged from the port tunnel with Irene towering at his side, 40 armed men at their backs.
"Some heady conspiracy, I'm sure."
Surprised, Rodion raised his hands in a gesture of helplessness and welcome, the pistol lolling from one finger.
"Gol! You're just in time to see the execution of a pitiful mastermind. He meant to smuggle..."
"Did you do that?" Gol interrupted, pointing at the horribly listing Stone Cloud. Surprised, Rodion was too slow to form an elegant answer, which was just as good as a confession to Gol.
"So, you've ransacked my port, wrecked a ship which, according to every law of safe harbour, was under our protection, and apparently executed Tom, Dick and Harry between here and Thursday to punish this man for passing a little contraband?"
Rodion found his smile.
"Well, of course, that makes it all sound a little rash."
The whoremonger was keeping one eye on Irene, who stood with a bland, almost bored expression on her broad face.
"But Finn, this man—" "Get up, Thomas. I can't talk with you crouching there like a scolded dog. You too, Adamos."
Gol again interrupted the whoremonger.
"This man," Rodion resumed, "is wanted by Commissioner Pound of the Baths, and I'm very certain it has something to do with this box, which he was trying to sneak out on that ship. I only found all this out yesterday, and I wanted to confirm it before I involved you, Finn. Look, here's the flat of it, Rodion. You shouldn't be here," Gol said. "I know all about this idiot's troubled past, but if the Commissioner wants him, he can come collect him. No one's stopping him. The fact that Tom is still alive suggests that either he's paid his debts, or they weren't very grand to begin with."
All were surprised when Adam spoke up.
"No, he was waiting for the painting to come out in the open."
"What?"
Gol said, expressing everyone's puzzlement.
"What painting?"
"He didn't know what happened to the painting Senlin stole from him, but he wanted it back, very badly, very badly."
Senlin looked at his friend, his expression wrinkled with confusion.
"What are you saying?
I brought this on you. When you told me that the commissioner would pay a fortune to get back what you'd stolen, I wrote him to see how much a fortune was.
Adam's tone was so flat, his confession seemed to rise from a hypnotic state.
I agreed to find the painting. I agreed to steal back what you'd stolen. It never occurred to me that Pound didn't know where you were. I didn't know I was drawing a target on your head. I tied the grappling line to the baths. I was going to use it to send the painting down. I didn't know I was giving that madman a way up. When the Red Hand came to torture a confession out of you, I knew I'd made a mistake. I wrote to Pound and told him that he could keep his fortune. I was done.
Adam shivered, and once he began, he could hardly stop the tremor.
But Rodion is right. You don't conspire with the Commissioner. He crushes and he takes. I'd gotten his attention. He knew who I was, and he quickly found out about Valita.
Adam's face was as pale as wax. The first glint of snow arrived, the crystals so small they made the air twinkle.
I'd never heard such threats, never imagined such cruelties as what he promised for me and my sister. I had to produce the painting.
Adam looked wounded when he finally met Senlin's unbelieving gaze.
But you wouldn't tell me where it was. I searched your room and your office, and I begged you to tell me.
I was trying to protect you, Senlin murmured.
The snow clouds reflected the light of the port lamps and glowed orange like smoke from wet firewood. A moment before, he had not thought that he could feel more alone. His wife was lost, perhaps irretrievably so. Edith was dead, and Ogier with her. Taru was buried in slavery. Adam's betrayal seemed the crowning defeat. He had no friends. Yet even as he thought it, his heart bucked. He was succumbing to self-pity. True, Adam had made a grave mistake, but it had been a mistake of desperation and naivety. Senlin had made plenty of those since his arrival. And hadn't Adam rescued him from the Red Hand at great risk to himself? Hadn't Adam gone along with Senlin's plan, though it seemed, and proved to be, the height of folly? Really, was Senlin any better of a friend? Perhaps not. But then, could any of these arguments, sanguine as they were, ever restore his trust in Adam? Senlin was unsure, but he decided, with only minutes remaining to his life, that he would try to forgive Adam at least. Rodion, smiling like a man vindicated by the ruling of a court, lowered his ivory-stocked cannon at the desolate and shivering Adam.
"And there you have it," he said. "The conspiracy undressed."
Fingal held up a staying hand.
"This boy's blunders don't do any service to your own, Rodion. Put the gun up. Adam, what's the last thing you told the commissioner?"
The painting was coming into the open. I told him that it would be on the humblest ship in port tonight and easily picked.
That's what I'm trying to tell you. I'm confessing now, because he's coming. He's coming here, tonight.
As suspicious as they'd all been of one another a moment before, they shared a single spasm of fear now. Each one in the uncomfortable, hostile assembly took a silent stock of their chances. Senlin suppressed a morbid urge to laugh. Here he thought he'd overloaded the gun, had set too many cocks loose in the yard. The commissioner would overshadow them all.
"Where's the painting?" Gull asked,
and it took Senlin a moment to realize he was the object of the question. When he looked, Gull was glaring at him hotly.
"No lies, Tom. I'm in no mood."
"In the crate," Senlin said, gesturing at the box that had naturally, inexplicably, migrated to the center of their gathering.
"Open it up, Irene,"
Gull directed, and the hulking woman obediently took a knee, stooping close to the small crate. What came over Rodion was not exactly clear. Perhaps it calculated his odds of surviving the evening and not liked the results. Or perhaps he saw opportunity in this moment of discovery to change the focus of power. And it could just as easily have been a spasm of wrath or terror that made him set his pistol to the back of Irene's ear. Senlin didn't think. He just moved his arm, his hand bursting from his pocket like a startled bird from a bush. The modest pop of powder sounded like a champagne cork. A red tear stood out under Rodion's eye, and the fur-lined whoremonger reached up to brush it away. But the tear swelled when he touched it, and then, like an open faucet, began raining down his face. Rodion let loose an awful rattling snore, and then fell dead amid a fine powder of snow. Senlin lowered the jailer's key when he realized he was being stared at, not least of all by Irene, who raised herself up amid a great creak of leather and rasp of chain.
"Well, that's one riddle answered," Gull said.
Senlin brimmed with disgust, though not regret. When Gull spoke again, there was no malice to his announcement, but neither was there any uncertainty.
"While we're hurrying through the uncomfortable consequences, Irene, would you please deliver Adam to the eternal bosom of the earth, quick as you can?"
The Amazon's usual iron mask seemed to warp at the corners, and her expression became so anguished that for a moment Senlin thought she might be stifling a violent sneeze. Then she reached, halting more than once, for the chain that encircled her. A chorus of gasps from the 40 men spared Adam his eulogy. They turned as one, and were all transfixed by the vision of three black moons rising over the horizon of the platform's end. The dawning silhouette was unmistakable. The hull was like an uprooted colosseum. It was the Ararat, the Commissioner's flying fortress, the most feared airship in his fleet. No sooner had the cannon hatches cleared the limb of the port than they began to fire. Their target was immediately apparent. The tethered Goldfinch, the regal merchant ship. A dozen holes perforated the hull, delicate where they entered and jagged where they left. The artfully carved flourishes of balustrades and bulwarks burst into puffs of plaster. The Finch's crew, who'd gone below decks to weather the storm, came pouring from the galley hatch in a frenzy. But before any could get to port, the centermost of the ship's furnaces were struck by the ricochet of a cannonball. The devastated furnace ignited the umbilical, which fled like a fuse to the mass of hydrogen gas contained above. Ignited, the gas inside blossomed into orange flame. The fire devoured the long silk envelope, spreading with the surreal deliberation of a burning page. The ship did not drop so much as rapidly sink, the withering flames glowing and falling as the moorings were torn from the port, and the hull rolled, screeching from its insufficient cradle. A moment later, there was nothing left of the Goldfinch but embers glowing in the dark, like the candles of a vigil. Chapter 17. I still recall a line from that feckless Everyman's Guide. It said something like, "The tower's real trade is in whimsy, adventure, and romance." I cannot imagine a less accurate trio. Though, who in their right minds would have come if the editors had said, "The tower's true trade is in tyranny, dismemberment, and heartbreak"? Every Man's Tower, One Man's Travails, by T. Senlin. The snow revealed the shape of the wind. Senlin watched as distinct gusts pulled at the fire that had leapt from the Goldfinch to the port. Feeding on the coal dust that coated the dock, the flames flashed toward the tower. The blaze soon divided the porters. Half flew back to the tunnel before the fire cut them off from escape. The other half, whether out of courage or surprise, remained outside in the pall of the Commissioner's warship. The deck guns of the Ararat fired a volley of harpoons at the platform, and for a moment it looked as if a monstrous nautilus was grasping for the port with its mass of tentacles. Then the grappling spears bit into the wood beams, and the trailing lines were pulled taut. A bevy of blue-coated agents zipped down the lines, clinging to pulleys that piled at the end of the line like the beads of an abacus. The men drew their sabers the moment their boots hit the ground, and in seconds the Commissioner had a platoon standing on the port of Gol. The agents, in stark contrast to the natives of the port, were uniformly arrayed in epaulettes and gold braids. They appeared professional and calm in a manner that unnerved Rodion's remaining stagehands and Gol's porters.
These ragtag defenders would have likely broken and run, even into the fire, had it not been for Irene. Swinging her hook and chain at her side, she rallied the men from behind, chasing them into battle. Gol had vanished. It was no surprise to Senlin that the diminutive boss had fled. He had survived the tower on the merit of his wits rather than his fists. And anyway, it took a very small helping of wits to recognize just how dire the situation was. Momentarily forgotten amid the new war, Senlin gripped Adam by the arm and said, "I'll rake you over the coals later. There's no time for it now. Get to the ship, feed the furnace, be ready to launch the moment we're aboard."
"What are you going to do?"
"I'm going to make sure Irene is coming with us." Adam, who moments before had been convinced the Amazon was ready to strike him dead, was not thrilled by the announcement.
"Leave her. She's a beast."
Senlin grabbed Adam up by the shirt front and pulled him near enough that the young man could feel the force of Senlin's breath when he said,
"Say aye-aye, Adam."
Adam's eyes were wide and bright with alarm. He had not seen this side of Senlin before. Senlin knew he could no longer afford to negotiate and explain every point and action to Adam. Either Adam would follow his orders now, or he never would. The sooner that was established, the better. Their noses hovered nearly together a moment longer. Then Adam repeated the phrase, and added a word he'd used before, but never meant, not until now.
"Aye, aye, Captain."
By the time Senlin located his aero rod in the piling snow and joined the fight, it was apparent he was on the wrong side of a rout. Rodion's men, already wounded and spent from grappling with the crew of the Stone Cloud, and demoralized by the loss of their leader, fell quickly before the Commissioner's agents. The porters fared little better. What heart they had was torn apart by the organization of their enemy. The porters were used to scrapping in the yard or charging as a mob, both useless tactics against a force of superior numbers and training. Only Irene gave them hope against the onslaught. She, by herself, was more devastating than a bank of riflemen. Her leather apron flared as her thick arm snapped life into her chain. The agents caught in the path of her hook looked as if they had fallen under a buzzsaw. They attempted to swarm her, but she refused to stand still for the dogpiling. She leapt about, mad as a top and nearly as nimble as Valita. Twice an agent fired at her, and twice the bullet was late, cutting at her blur, passing through the air, and finding a fellow agent to burrow into. Senlin couldn't reach her. Every time he thought he might have beaten a path through, the way would clog with retreating agents, clutching ruined limbs and gushing wounds. They were desperate to get away from Irene and her great mauling propeller. Even amid the chaos, Senlin could not help but to admire her grace, gruesome as it was. In her warring, he saw all the lessons she'd drummed into him, here combined into a single fluid reflex. He'd long suspected that she had been overly hard on him when they'd sparred, but now he knew just how gingerly she had handled him. He'd been a cub in the mouth of a lion. She was a master of violence. She was indomitable, and she was winning the war. Then a familiar, ungainly figure climbed over the rampart of the Ararat. The bulbous middle and spindly arms, the broad straw hat and white linen clothes were unmistakable. The spectre released the zipline while he still hung 20 feet from the ground. He landed in a crouch in the clearing Irene had cut through the ranks of men. The agents opened the circle even farther, like a snake's mouth widening to make room for the appearance of the fangs. The red hand straightened and said,
"Did you know that this is only the third time it has snowed in the Valley of Babel this century? It's quite rare. I'm so glad you got to experience it."
The snow was driving now, and had begun to snuff the fires that lapped futilely against the tower's stony face. Though Senlin wanted to believe that this opened the door for reinforcements, it seemed more likely that it opened the door for retreat. For the moment at least, the few porters still on their feet appeared intent on watching the coming contest between the champion of the port and the commissioner's dog. Even they were not immune to local pride. The two gladiators could not have been more different. Irene swung her chain above her head until, tightened by velocity, its ringing became a clear musical chord. The red hand tweaked the pegs on his brass cuff.
The vials of red, luminous serum flared as they sloshed and drained into his arm. He appeared no more anxious than a man winding an old fine watch. Irene scuffed elegant figures out in the snow as she circled. The red hand clasped his hands behind his back and seemed to glow a little more brightly. If the red hand was trying to lull her into thinking he was not a fierce and worthy rival, it didn't work. Irene whipped the chain out at the level of his hips, meaning to break the assassin in half. The red hand flattened himself, collapsed as if he'd been sucked to the ground, and her chain whizzed harmlessly over him. He had popped back to his feet before the hook had snapped back to her hand.
"We are on the leeward side of the mountains," he said. "Iron ore is more easily mined on the lee side because of a historical dearth of vegetation turning to soil and burying the rock. Not to mention, of course, the lack of rain and snow."
Again she paced. Again she swung the chain, forcing it around faster and faster until the veins stood out on the raised pillar of her arm and the sinews in her jaw bulged like a welded joint. She heaved it at the assassin with an explosive grunt, and it sliced at an angle, intent on the notch between his shoulder and neck. He leaned back, a subtle but sufficient dodge, and snatched the slowing chain from the air once it had passed him. He yanked it sharply, and Irene, unbraced, fell into him. He caught her chin with what seemed a simple uppercut, though the result was dramatic. The blow raised her off her feet. She arched backward, bounced once on her shoulder blades, and slid 10 feet in the snow, flat on her back. She hardly had time to lower her chin to her chest before the red hand had leapt on her. She was quick to move before he could pinch his knees into her ribs. Twisting her legs around his, she flipped him under her. She grabbed him by the neck and began to beat him ruthlessly about the head. It was a pure drumming, like a blacksmith hurrying to hammer a rod before it's had time to cool. His hat torn from his head, exposing his blonde, infantile hair, the red hand seemed momentarily dazed, vulnerable. The detached smirk was gone, his lips now bunching to preserve his teeth. But her advantage did not last long, and the blows that would have killed another man only stirred this one's blood. The red hand wriggled one arm from where Irene had pinned it under her knee, and latched onto her wrist with all the determination of a shackle. He twisted his hold with such violence, Irene was thrown from her perch on his chest, though she managed to funnel her momentum into a defensive roll. Separated, they bounced to their feet. Irene pulled a spike from her belt and threw it at the villain. It stuck, quivering 2 inches into the man's flesh, just beneath the sternum. The surrounding agents shared a communal gasp. Senlin's heart leapt to his throat as he stood craning over the wall of Gorkhas. She had done it! Surely this was a fatal blow. They all waited for him to collapse. But he did not. The red hand snorted, like a man shaken from a shallow nap, and reached up to pluck the spike from his chest. It came out as easily as a thorn. The wound seeped with luminous blood, but bled only a little.
"Iron ore can be tempered into steel, or it can be filed and transformed into the lightest of gases, hydrogen. This illustrates the paradox of consciousness. We are vapor in rigid form."
Reflexively, Irene swiveled out of the way when the red hand returned the spike to her in the same manner he'd received it. The missile narrowly missed her head. The red hand leapt like a man launched from a catapult. Flying over her head, he grabbed her by the shoulders and flipped over her back. He pulled her along with him, as if she were little more than a cape. When he came down on his feet, she was hurled over his head, high into the air. She struck the smoking scaffolding of a scorched crane upside down and flat on her back. Already weakened from the fire, the whole structure collapsed on top of her. She surely would have been burned alive if the snow had not recently doused the blaze. Senlin could only see her boots jutting lifelessly from the haystack of charred wood. Senlin turned to run to her, but was caught immediately from behind by a pair of agents, a man on each of his arms. With Irene dispatched, there was nothing left to distract them from him. The agents wheeled him around and frog-marched him toward the Ararat. The red hand brushed with annoyance at the bloody gouge that marred his shirt. He found his hat, which was rumpled but not torn, and returned it to his head. A drawbridge opened near the base of the floating fortress. The lip of the bridge dragged unsteadily back and forth across the pier, as the immense vessel wrestled to hold firm amid the storm. Commissioner Pound, dressed in a severe black suit and wearing his monstrous gas mask, crossed the bridge briskly. Senlin was forced to face the hypochondriac tyrant, who stood casually tightening the fingers of his gloves and surveying the battleground.
"Scour the port! Bring me any cargo that you find," he ordered his men, and then turning to Senlin said, "If you only knew whom you have troubled with this idiotic caper."
His voice buzzed through the blunt silver tusks of his mask.
"I'm not even allowed to kill you, because there is a long and illustrious line of men who want to contribute to your demise. They will have to hold a lottery, I suppose, or draw straws for the pleasure of dissecting you."
Senlin shrugged almost demurely, as if he were pleasantly surprised by all this attention.
"Perhaps you could hold an auction. I know how you art collectors love auctions. What quicker way is there to inflate the price of some poor artist's work?"
Senlin stared into the smoked glass lenses of the gas mask, as if he could see the man's high forehead, womanish skin, and colourless eyes. Senlin wanted the commissioner to know he was not afraid.
"My crime is that I returned a creation to its creator."
A sound like a rook's cry burst from the mask, then repeated three more times. The commissioner was laughing at him. The man bent at the waist and rolled his head.
"You're talking about that horrible humpbacked amateur. He didn't paint that masterpiece." "Of course he did. It was signed, and I saw his other works. His name was Ogier. Or was that some wild coincidence?" "He was an impostor and a forger who fell in love with his charade. He even went so far as to recreate the real Ogier's studio above that blasted perfumery, so all of his paintings would reek just as badly as the originals."
The commissioner was still in good humour, plainly revelling in Senlin's confusion.
"The painting you stole is 100 years old."
"So why did he ask me to steal it?" Senlin asked, his confidence curling into bewilderment.
"Ah,"
the commissioner said, drawing close. He patted Senlin flatly on the chest, as if he were an old horse. His confidence shaken, Senlin could no longer imagine Pound's hidden expression. He only saw his own reflection, doubled in the commissioner's lenses. He looked no larger than a picture in a locket.
"That is the question. Why did he ask you to steal it? And why did he not keep it? Why did he give it to you?"
Senlin recovered his slipping self-possession and said, "You should have asked him." The commissioner stepped back.
"Oh, I wanted to, though I have a pretty good idea what he would have said. This is an old feud. Still, I would have liked to converse with the painter, but you know how it is, Mr. Senlin. Sometimes a falconer can't keep his falcon from tearing up the hair."
The commissioner nodded at the red hand, who was at that moment appearing through the snow. The red hand carried Senlin's crate under his arm. He set the box at the commissioner's feet with great care.
"This was the centre of a lot of attention. There was a circle of tracks and a body."
"Open it,"
the commissioner said. Senlin was confounded by the revelation that Ogier was a fraud, but he had no time to consider it now. All of his attention fell upon the booby-trapped crate and the red hand hovering over it. The red hand, hardly needing tools to pry free the nailed lid, delicately wrenched the top off. A thicket of straw packing stared back at him, and he began to pluck the stuffing from the box until the edge of a canvas was revealed. As the red hand worked, puffs of white powder were shaken free of the straw. The powder swirled in the air, the clouds mingling with the snow. No one seemed to notice its presence, except for Senlin, who was looking for it. He had laced the packing straw with enough white crom to drug 100 men. He held his breath. The red hand pulled the painting free, turning it toward the commissioner. Pound's voice cracked with anger.
What is this?
He snatched the painting and thrust it into Senlin's face. Senlin, who thought he was about to be struck, gasped. A familiar tingling sensation instantly bloomed in his sinuses and ran down his throat. He cringed. He'd meant to use the crumb as a last-ditch attack on the senses and faculties of his enemies. His own exposure to the powerful narcotic had, of course, not been part of his plan. Before the commissioner could interrogate Senlin further, the Red Hand abruptly reeled back with a wild snort, startling everyone.
"Who's there?"
he cried. His eyes glazed as they tracked unseen spectres. The Red Hand flinched and swatted at the air, recoiling from some sound no one else could hear. The commissioner tried to bark his assassin back to his senses, but the Red Hand's mind had wandered beyond reach. He backed into an agent who stood frozen in terror. The Red Hand, startled, spun about and snapped the man's head around until his chin hung over his spine. The man dropped like a wet towel. The scene quickly descended into chaos. The Red Hand tore into the ranks of his compatriots, his uncanny strength heightened by his frenzy. He used the men like clubs, beating one against another until both were lifeless husks. He flung men from the port as if they were boneless and weightless. The snow blushed red as the warmth that leaked from the maimed and the fallen turned the powder into slush. The Red Hand cried,
"Who's there?"
again and again, though no one dared to answer him. Shots were fired and swords were swung, but these just extended the gore as panic led to crossfire and wild strikes. The men holding Senlin did not release him, but they did retreat a few paces, holding him as a helpless shield between them and the berserk assassin. Senlin, craning his neck about for some sign of help or escape, caught sight of something that would have made his heart swell if he hadn't been sure it was a hallucination brought on by the crumb. What he saw was impossible. Edith was running toward him, dashing the commissioner's men aside, her elbow raised like the wedge of a plough. It was a wonderful vision, but this was the tower, he reminded himself. No one was coming to the rescue. The Red Hand, having devastated the commissioner's force, now turned to Senlin, still pinned up by his arms. The assassin's veins shone so brightly that they radiated through his skin. He was webbed with fire. The Red Hand leapt at them behind an arm that jutted like a battering ram. Senlin threw all of his weight to his right, pulling the agent on his left into the line of attack. The blow landed on the man's ear. The struck man stiffened and fell, pulling Senlin and the other agent into a flailing pile. Sandwiched between the two men, one unconscious, perhaps dead, the other terrified and cursing, Senlin tried to pull himself out. The weight on top of him vanished as the Red Hand plucked up the profanely babbling agent by the neck, pinching off the flow of words and holding him like a farmer holds a chicken for the block. The Red Hand squeezed the man's neck until it made a sudden, wet, cracking sound, like an egg dropped on the floor. Rocking like a crab on its back, helplessly caught on the soft fulcrum of the agent beneath him, Senlin gaped up at the haunted executioner. There was no cruelty or malevolence in his expression. The Red Hand twitched and blinked almost childishly. He said,
"Who's there?"
But weakly. His intelligence had fled, his docent manner reduced to a mere primitive instinct. He reached for Senlin almost in boredom, though his hand was a radiant star. Edith's fist struck the assassin's temple with the speed of a train running downhill. The blow sent the Red Hand sprawling across the snowy planks on his side. "How?" Senlin asked, disbelieving her presence even now. Only later would Edith explain how she'd caught the rope of an anchor and swung into the trestlework under the platform. She'd caromed about like a billiard ball and nearly fallen to her death, but she had caught a handful of snagged silk, a tangled remnant of the fallen finch. She then spent the next half hour shinnying up frozen iron crosses amid a centurial blizzard. Edith yanked Senlin to his feet, saying,
"We must get to the ship!"
Even as she spoke, the Red Hand had come again to his feet. One of his eyes bulged out of its socket, cocked at a wild, blind angle. Red light poured through the gap. The blow seemed to have blunted his drug-induced mania. What remained of his gaze was clearer now, and trained chillingly upon Edith. He flew at her, and she caught him by the hands. They grappled on unsteady footing, careening about in the deepening snow. Senlin drew the sword from the scabbard of an agent who would have no further use of it. He was about to go to Edith's aid when her sabre flashed between them, quick as a guillotine.